May I have your attention? I have the pleasure this afternoon of introducing John Haynes. But before I do, I'd like to remind you of the other events this week. Tomorrow, here in the Gallery Lounge at 2:30, there'll be the second Robinson Jeffers program. Eric Vaughan in the Labyrinth Theater will read a program called Poetry of War and Peace, 1918 to 1962. I've heard them read the program, and it's very impressive and very moving. That's tomorrow at 2:30 here in the Gallery Lounge. Admission is free. Then tomorrow night at 8:15 at Veterans Auditorium downtown at Civic Center, the Poetry Center is presenting the culminating event in this Robinson Jeffers program. It will combine the first showing of a film, not one that you've seen on television, a film commissioned by NET on Robinson Jeffers called Give Your Heart to the Hawks. That was mistakenly named by the Examiner Give Your Heat to the Hawks. I guess you give your heat to the Hawks and your heart to the Doves, perhaps. Anyway, the name of the film is Give Your Heart to the Hawks. Judith Anderson is in the film, and she will also make a personal appearance and will read from Medea and other works of Jeffers. That's tomorrow night at 8:15 at Veterans Auditorium. Then on Thursday, the 13th, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, here in the Gallery Lounge, John Logan will read from his work. John Logan is here on a tour from the University in Buffalo, New York. He is taking the place, which was originally, we originally assumed that Anselm Hollow would be here to read on the 13th, but Hollow will not be able to make it. John Logan was going to be on the West Coast, so we grabbed the opportunity. So John Logan then will read here on Thursday at 1 in the afternoon. I'm happy today to welcome John Haynes to the Poetry Center and to the campus of San Francisco State College. John Haynes's poems, it seems to me, are unusual in a certain way in contemporary American writing. Haynes is the son of a Navy officer and was himself a Navy veteran of World War II. He began not as a poet, but as a student of painting and sculpture in Washington and in New York in the late 1940s, but found himself drawn increasingly to poetry and to Alaska. He went there for the first time in 1947, and for 13 years now, he has lived the life of an Alaskan frontiersman in a house he built 70 miles from Fairbanks. His work, published in many magazines, and in his first collection, published last year, called Winter News, his work expresses his relation to the wilderness world of space, snow, and animals. The image, I suppose that the image of the sensitive man thinking meanings in the midst of a vast continent which threatens to dwarf those meanings, which threatens to dwarf the effort at meaning even, is a familiar one in American literature. But it is rare, I think, to find a poet who deliberately chooses so stark a locale and who proceeds to define his ambiguous relation to it with such precision and distinctness of detail. Vividly, he gives us a whole wilderness world in which to be. He is in it, yet he is never wholly of it. And it is that combination which provides the tensions and resonance in his work. John Haynes gives us himself in his world, a world very unlike our own, but one in which we can genuinely believe. I give you John Haynes.
I'm going to read a few poems from Winter News, and I also have a few poems that are not in the book, some one or two newer poems. And if anybody wants to ask me any questions, why you interrupt me any time you want. First poem is called Winter News, and it grew out of a weather report we heard on the radio one winter. And there's a little town called Northway, about 100 miles or so from home down toward Canada. And I heard that it was cold enough, the wells were freezing. And out of this weather report, some images began to collect, and I wrote this rather short poem. They say the wells are freezing at Northway where the cold begins. Oil tins bang as evening comes on, and clouds of steaming breath drift in the street. Men go out to feed the stiffening dogs. The voice of the snowman calls the white-haired children home. The poem of the forgotten. This is another rather short and simple poem, just sort of a little biography or autobiography. I came to this place, a young man, green and lonely. Well quit of the world, I framed a house of moss and timber, called it a home, and sat in the warm evenings singing to myself as a man sings when he knows there is no one to hear. I made my bed under the shadow of leaves and awoke in the first snow of autumn, filled with silence. The mole. Sometimes I envy those who spring like great black and gold butterflies before the crowded feet of summer. Brief, intense, like pieces of the sun, they are remembered and celebrated long after night has fallen. But I believe also in one who in the dead of winter tunnels through a damp, clinging darkness, nosing the soil of old gardens. He lives unnoticed, but deep within him there is a dream of the surface one day breaking and crumbling. And a small brown-furred figure stands there, blinking at the sky, as the rising sun slowly dries his strange, unruly wings. This next poem is Fairbanks Under the Solstice, and it's a picture, actually, of Fairbanks when it is very cold. We have something there we call ice fog. It begins to form at about 35 degrees below zero, and mixed in this fog as it gets colder is smoke from chimneys and automobile exhaust, and it gets very thick sometimes. And it's very strange, somewhat like being at the bottom of a frozen ocean with the very shadowy people walking around through it. Slowly without sun, the day sinks toward the close of December. It is minus 60 degrees. Over the sleeping houses, a dense fog rises, smoke from banked fires, and the snowy breath of an abyss through which the cold town is perceptibly falling. As if death were a voice made visible with the power of illumination. Now in the white shadow of those streets, ghostly newsboys make their rounds, delivering to the homes of those who have died of the frost, word of the resurrection of silence. This poem is called The House of the Injured. I found a house in the forest, small, windowless, and dark. From the doorway came the close, suffocating odor of blood and fur mixed with dung. I looked inside and saw an injured bird that filled the room. With a stifled croaking, it lunged toward the door as if held back by an invisible chain. The beak was half eaten away, and its heart beat wildly under the rumpled feathers. I sank to my knees, a man shown the face of God. So to turn back, this poem partly grew out of some reminiscences of Indian stories about they would refer to them, grass people and the stone people and so on and so forth. The grass people bow their heads before the wind. How would it be to stand among them, bending our heads like that? Yes and no, perhaps, lifting our dusty faces as if we were waiting for the rain. The grass people stand all year, patient and obedient. To be among them is to have only simple and friendly thoughts, and not to be afraid. I wrote a number of poems about hunting and animals, and one fall, my wife and I were camped in a tent. We were building a cabin. It was quite a few miles from home, and I was also looking for a moose. And there was a moose in the vicinity, and I was trying to call him into this camp we had. And every evening, for several evenings, he would come down this creek bottom, and always after dark, so I never really got a good look at him. But anyway, I did write this poem about him called Horns. I went to the edge of the wood in the color of evening and rubbed with a piece of horn against a tree, believing the great dark moose would come. I fell asleep in an old white tent. The October moon rose, and down a wide frozen stream the moose came roaring, hoarse with rage and desire. I awoke and stood in the cold as he slowly circled the camp. His horns exploded in the brush with dry trees cracking and falling. His nostrils flared, his swollen neck smelling of challenge. He stalked by me. I called him back and he came and stood in the shadow not far away and gently rubbed his horns against the icy willows. I heard him breathing softly. Then, with a faint sigh of warning, soundlessly he walked away. I stood there in the moonlight, and the darkness and silence surged back, flowing around me, full of a wild enchantment, as though a god had spoken. Victims. This poem describes a little bit something that I've experienced more than once, but this occasion I had a quarter of moose that I'd brought into the house to thaw, so I'd take the hide off of it, and it was hanging from a beam in the room. And after I'd skinned it, I was sat down and was looking at it, and I saw these bones and veins, one thing working through the flesh. And I thought of it somehow as a forest of blood, and I also began thinking of what a human carcass would look like hung up like that, and just for the space of a second or a few seconds, it seemed to me that I'd been somehow cutting into my own flesh. The knife that makes long scars in the flesh lays bare the bones. Pale trees in the forest of blood, where the birds of life and death endlessly weave their nests with straws of anguish. There, the hunter and his quarry. Parting the branches, the doomed animal chokes on his own breath and sees, as in a red mist, his own dripping carcass.
Would you please hang up the telephone?
Little competition, huh?
Would you please hang up the phone? Would you read that one?
Yeah. The knife that makes long scars in the flesh lays bare the bones. Pale trees in the forest of blood, where the birds of life and death endlessly weave their nests with straws of anguish. There the hunter and his quarry. Parting the branches, the doomed animal chokes on his own breath and sees, as in a red mist, his own dripping carcass. I wrote three poems out of a hunting trip that I took into the high country one fall. And there was a little snow on the ground and a few bands of caribou suddenly showing up out of the rather peculiar yellow light that was hanging over the country. And some small fires here and there on the tundra. And one of the things that I saw was a tree sitting up on a knoll somewhere all by itself. And the highway running through this country is called the Denali Highway. This one short poem is called Denali Road. By the Denali Road, facing north, a battered chair in which nothing but the wind was sitting. And farther on toward evening, an old man with a vague smile, his rifle rusting in his arms. The field of the caribou. Moving in a restless exhaustion, humps of earth that rise covered with dead hair. There is no sound from the wind blowing the tattered velvet of their antlers. The gray shepherds of the tundra pass like islands of smoke, and I hear only a heavy thumping, as though far in the west some tired bodies were falling from a cliff. For a number of years there in Alaska, I had a kind of a conflict between a lot of work that I had to do and poetry. I had to be outside working all the time, and I looked forward to the winters when I could relax a little bit and read and write. And this poem's is about that, called Divided, the Man is Dreaming. One half lives in sunlight. He is the hunter and calls the beast of the field about him. Bathed in sweat and tumult, he slakes and kills, eats meat and knows blood. His other half lies in shadow and longs for stillness, a corner of the evening where birds rest from flight. Cool grass grows at his feet. Dark mice feed from his hands. There's a poem called The Cave of Animals, which contains something from my own experience, but also something reminiscence that come from the cave paintings, well-known cave paintings of France and Spain. Some of them are so much alone, the red cow with flowers in her mouth, and the small shaggy horse who has never known a rider. But the furious bison are dancing, the caribou are fording a river whose banks shelter a sunrise. The black bull of the night bellows, and the white bull of sunlight answers. Dawn breaks over a yellow silence in the earth. This deserted cabin was written about a home of an old man that I used to know. I went hunting with and picking berries and such things. And after he died, I was up on the hill where his cabin was. This is several years afterwards. And also a little bit in this poem is something that I remembered from Chinese poetry, where sometimes they poet is sitting in some ruin somewhere, meditating on past glories and all that sort of thing. Here in the yellowing aspen grove on Campbell's Hill, the wind is searching a fallow garden. I remember the old man who lived here. 5 years have gone by, and his house has grown to resemble his life. A shallow cave hung with old hides, rusty traps and chains, smelling of 80 years of unwashed bedding and rotting harness. I see him sitting there now as he used to, his starved animals gathered about his bony knees. He talks to himself of poverty, cursing softly, jabbing a stick at the shadows. The bitterness of a soul that wanted only to walk in the sun and pick the ripening berries. It is like coming home late in the evening with a candle in your hand, and meeting someone you had forgotten. The voice is strange. It is the cold autumn wind stirring the frozen grass, as if some life had just passed there, bound home in the early darkness. This next poem is one of a couple that I wrote about owls, but my wife made a little Christmas card once, and a little painting of a snowy owl, and I made up this little verse to go with the card, called Prayer to the Snowy Owl. Descend, silent spirit, you whose golden eyes pierce the gray shroud of the world, marvelous ghost, drifter of the Arctic night, destroyer of those who gnaw in the dark, preserver of whiteness. This Dream of the Lynx, the next poem I'm going to read, is partly dream. I sometimes spent the winters trapping, and when I came home, I would be thinking about the trail that was out there that I'd just come over, and maybe some animal coming along, getting caught in a trap, and it describes somewhat the a state that would come when I was just about to fall asleep, and these things would be showing up in my mind. Beside a narrow trail in the blue cold of evening, the trap is sprung, and the growling deep in the throat tells of life risen to the surface of darkness. The moon in my dream takes the shape of animals who walk by its light and never sleep, whose yellow eyes are certain of what they seek. Sinking, floating beneath the eyelid, the hairy shape of the slayer appears, a shadow that crouches hidden in a thicket of alders, nostrils quivering, and the ever-deepening track of the unseen feeding host. The Visitor. Sometimes when it was very cold, they would have to have a door open for a minute to cool the house off if it was very hot from cooking a meal or something, and this tremendous cloud of steam would roll across the floor. And I once began thinking of it as some kind of an animal that was coming into the house. The door is open, and the shaggy frost fog bounds across the floor and wraps itself about my feet. Restless, it climbs upon my knees. I feel its breath deep in my bones. A spirit in it wants to draw me out past the whitening hinges into the cold, enormous rooms where it lives. Out there, a flickering pathway leads to a snowy grave where something in me has always wanted to lie. Then let it take me, a lost, shivering animal, eyelids shut fast, hands folded, wrapped in a stillness made of ice and starlit tears. There's another short poem about animals. The sound of animals in the night. Dark wings that brush the foliage above us, the crunch of hoofs and frost, a river flowing in the lonely voice of the coyote. As they walk through the moonlight, we come and go by the flare of campfires, full of ghosts with huge wounded hearts. A small poem called The Tree. It's really a rather almost a conventional image of man's life as a tree that is growing. Tree of my life, you have grown slowly in the shadows of giants. Through darkness and solitude, you stretch year by year toward that strange clear light in which the sky is hidden. In the quiet grain of your thoughts, the inner life of the forest stirs like a secret still to be named. This next poem is almost purely imaginary, just some images that came into my mind or imagination or whatever it was to around the idea of night coming over the country. The sea is lifting something on the shores of darkness, a slime of rumors and burial that slides inland and covers the sleeping waste. Ooze and watery silence, liquefying bones, as it might be in a tomb where the dead lie rotting and listening, a cold, sucking mouth at the door of my dream. One fall, I picked potatoes just to earn a few dollars, and after the day was over, there'd be a few of us left on the field in this very strange red light coming up. It was a very dry and dusty fall. And somehow it struck me as it might be after some catastrophe, another world war, when there'd be only a few people left and conversation would be practically meaningless. It's called pickers. All day we were bent over, lifting handfuls of wind and dust. Scraps of some human conversation blew by. A coffin on wheels rolled slowly backward across the field, and the skinned bodies of the harvest were loaded. A red cloud boiling up out of the darkness became the evening. Sentinels of a shattered army, we drank bitter coffee and spoke of the field, the light, and the cold. This is a poem I wrote about the time of one of the Cuban crises, and we sometimes had maneuvers, military maneuvers, and we had these long lines of military vehicles driving down the highway in front of the house, and anyway, out of all this, number of images, one thing another, came up that I made into a poem called The End of the Summer. Let the inhuman drab machines patrol the road that leads nowhere, and the men with Bibles and speeches come to the door asking directions. We will turn them all away and be alone. We will not storm what barricades they erect on the Cuban beaches, or set forth on the muddy imperial water. At least we shall go to hell with open faces. The sun keeps its promises, sentry in the cloth of departure. The forest is empty, the people are gone, the smoky paths awaiting the feet of furred and silent soldiers. Death, the surveyor, plots his kingdom of snow. Subversive leaves, you fall and litter the camps of our enemies. Unheard of wars sweep down from distant mountains, filling the cemeteries of the unborn. Survivors beat with pale hands upon the windows. Their eyelids are closed and their scars sealed with gauze against the cold. I stare across the threshold of my home and feel the sudden wind that rises like the breath from a grave. Watching the fire. Where are the red men? They should be here. They saw the mound of skulls glowing on the hearth. For them the stone lamp flickered, and the drafty cave was walled with visions. The stories they told us were true. We should have believed them. A woman of brute form nurses her child. Wise eyes and a wrinkled skin, forehead of horn. He wears a necklace of fangs and cries softly for flesh and blood. This poem is called Listening in October, and late in the fall, I would be working outdoors. I'd come in about the time it was getting dark, it might be 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And we had no radio or music or anything at the time. So we would be sitting there probably having coffee or tea, and it would be very quiet. In the quiet house, a lamp is burning where the Book of Autumn lies open on a table. There is tea with milk in heavy mugs, brown raisin cake, and thoughts that stir the heart with the promises of death. We sit without words, gazing past the limit of fire into the towering darkness. There are silences so deep, you can hear the journeys of the soul, enormous footsteps downward in a freezing earth. There's a very short poem called What is Life, and it's about as much of a philosophy as I've been ever capable of. There are no roads but the paths we make through sleep and darkness. An invisible friend, a ghost like a black wind that buffets and steadies the lost bystander who thinks he sees. Into the Glacier. This is just an imaginary journey into some ice. We used to have to chop ice, well, we still do chop ice for water in the winter. And we have something called overflow, which means that springs in the ground will be frozen for a certain length of time. And then the weather will let up a little bit and the water will flow out over the ice, and it comes out sometimes in very different colors. And I imagine somehow making a journey into this ice at one time. With a green lamp of the spirit of sleeping water taking us by the hand. Deeper and deeper, a luminous blackness opening like the wings of a raven, as though a heavy wind were rising through all the houses we ever lived in. The cold rushing in, our blankets flying away into the darkness, and we, naked and alone, awakening forever. This next poem, The Tundra, goes back to a couple I read earlier about the high country with this kind of a primeval light that was lying over the... Well, it was very easy to imagine that you might have been 20 or 30,000 years ago, except that people were hunting with guns instead of bows and arrows. The tundra is a living body, warm in the grassy autumn sun. It gives off the odor of crushed blueberries and gun smoke. In the tangled lakes of its eyes, a mirror of ice is forming, where frozen gut piles shine with a dull, rosy light. Coarse, laughing men with their women. One by one, the tiny campfires flaring under the wind. Full of blood, with a sound like clicking hoofs, the heavy tundra slowly rolls over and sinks in the darkness. This is an older poem that I was going to put in the book, but decided later that I would not. It's called The Hermitage. In the forest below the stairs, I have a secret home. My name is carved in the roots. I have a crevice stuffed with moss and a couch of lemming fir. I sit and listen to the music of water dripping on a distant stone, or I sing to myself of stealth and loneliness. No one comes to see me, but I hear outside the scratching of claws, the warm, inquisitive breath. And once, in a strange silence, I felt quite close the beating of a human heart. Mm-hmm. This poem called The Flight. It may happen again. This much we can always believe. When our dawn fills with frightened neighbors and the ancient car refuses to start. The gunfire of locks and shutters echoes next door to the house left open for the troops that are certain to come. We shall leave behind nothing but cemeteries, and our life like a refugee cart overturned in the road, a wheel slowly spinning. This is a recent poem called The Wreck. The church, like a wreck blown ashore from the Middle Ages, battering on a shoal at Finisterre. The seams have opened, and the sea, like a luminous window falling away, flashes briefly with icons, chalices, gold candlesticks. Angels and saints, their faces crusted with salt, draw near to the flooded railing. They try to sing. The wind, full of a wintry fervor, whips the Kyries from broken spars. And the figurehead on a cross has never moved. A conch mourns in the littered shallows. Unwieldy shapes, driftwood and sea coal, groan and struggle to their feet, survivors from a shipwreck of souls. Would anybody like to ask any questions or anything?
Could you read that divided self poem?
Oh, yeah. Divided, the man is dreaming. One half lives in sunlight. He is the hunter and calls the beast of the field about him. Bathed in sweat and tumult, he slakes and kills, eats meat and knows blood. His other half lies in shadow and longs for stillness, a corner of the evening where birds rest from flight. Cool grass grows at his feet, dark mice feed from his hand. I wrote a number of poems last winter about flowers, but most of them I didn't like. This one here, I think, is, I like it pretty well, about, called Larkspur. The blue giant is passing, king of this field. His trumpets blow pure cobalt. He brings with him audiences of the deepest indigo. By his command, the sky-stained meadows overflow, and bridges of azure stretch far into evening, where the king, his train halted, stands alone in his blueness.
Would you read that poem on Southern California?
You think I should read that?
Sure.
No, I don't know. I have not tried to read that. I don't know.
Try it.
No. Well, I went down to Southern California last fall for the first time in many years, and aside from the great shock of coming out into this civilization, traffic, and everything. I was under some emotional strain at the time. Anyway, but anyway, this I wrote this when I went back to Alaska, and it's kind of rhetorical, but I will read it since it's by request. That's called I Don't Want to Live in Southern California. Monotonous solitude of palms and pigeons, of smudged horizons. How your stone fields echo the chant of derricks. Their black lips suck at the feet of orchards where the age ripens its grimy fruit. This is where I grew quickly older and learned to be drunk and heard love squealing in the dark. I have never forgotten the announcements of war, the hush in schoolrooms, the Japanese faces turning aside, and the sad blue lamps of Coronado when the longed-for invasion failed. And I lived 3 years sweltering under a monsoon cloud as the oily disease of battle wasted some faraway islands. Only the sea was alive to me. I loved its wreckages and here and there a floating body. Then from the deck of a phantom ship, I saw this coast loom again in the winter sunlight. Cliffs peeling away like the petals of a scarred rose. And I sailed inland to pitch my camp where the ghosts of Indians stamped their feet in ashes. And now from any distance I smell the fumes of a million furnaces, the breath exhaled from exhausted metals and the broken souls of petroleum. As the turbines scream and shudder, scattering anathemas over the stricken towns, I dream of avenging angels. They are armed with enormous brooms. About what?
Boats.
No. Here's another poem I wrote last winter called Signs. One morning last summer, I saw incredible numbers of rodents scurrying through the grass. I said to myself, they are all moving in the same direction. Every evening at supper, I hear that a well-known delta has swallowed another platoon of soldiers, that the presidential stones are being consulted again, that a muddy Congress is eddying around some laws that will surely be broken. And long before midnight, the hands of astronomers are gathering in the planets and stars. And perfectly normal men and women have gone to bed, believing they have witnessed a glowing miracle in the skies. Are benign spirits out there wishing us well? If so, I have not heard them. This is another poem about the military maneuvers. I originally called it The Invaders, but I read it down in Michigan somewhere, and somebody thought I was referring to the Russians. So I decided to call it After the Winter Maneuvers. It was the country I loved, and they came over the hills at daybreak. Their armor hoisted a dirty cloud to the dawn, and the cold air glittered with harsh commands. Up and down the roads of Alaska, the clanging boot soles, the steely clatter of wheels, treading down forests, bruising the snows, bringing the blossom of an angry sundown, their cannon and blue flares, meaning fear of the night. Did I read that little thing on the spider or what?
Sure.
I've read this here and there. I'm still working on it, but it's called Simply Lies. The man from Texas is a coarse and wrinkled spider, spinning evil tales to children who are growing older. His lies are floated without warning. Wherever they land, they take hold. Over the heads of his listeners, something gray and sticky tightens like a helmet of dirty wool. Every time he taps one of his lies, another audience suddenly ages. This poem is to a man going blind. I picked up this man on the road a couple of years ago. He'd had some accident. Somebody had sprayed jet fuel in his face, and he killed the nerves, apparently, and he was losing his eyesight. And he was talking about having to go back down to where he had come from and get somebody to read his mail. And I wrote this poem sometime later. As you face the evenings coming on steeper and snowier, a winter that once begun will not turn back at the solstice, and someone you cannot see is reading in a strained voice from the Book of Storms. All the lamps of your hometown will not light the darkness growing across this landscape and within you, as you wait like a leaning flower and hear, almost as if it was nothing, the petrified rumble of a world going blind. This is the last poem that I wrote before I came down here, called Man is a Cave. This haunted self, scarred with landslides, pecked by flights and wars. His face sags in its cavern. His eyes give back a sky of limestone. His nostrils breathe the stale smoke of old campfires. His mouth is caving in upon the mystery of his origin. With his lamps blown out and his walls flaking in horror, he waits for a new glacier to seal his gaze with ice. This is another poem that I wrote. It wasn't last winter, last spring, I guess, called Moons. There are moons like continents diminishing to a white stone, softly smoking in a fog-bound ocean. Equinoctial moons, immense rain barrels spilling their yellow water. Moons like eyes turned inward, hard and bulging on the blue cheek of eternity, and moons half broken, eaten by eagle shadows. But the moon of the poet is soiled and scratched, its seas are flowing with dust, and other moons are rising, swollen like boils. In their bloodshot depths, the warfare of planets silently drips and festers. No questions or anything?
Would you read The Green Man?
Oh, The Green Man? Okay. And when the Green Man comes, the man is clothed in birch bark. Small birds cling to his limbs, and one builds a nest in his ear. The clamor of bedlam infests his hair. A wind blowing in his head shakes down a thought that turns to moss and lichen at his feet. His eyes are blind with April. His breath distilled the butterflies and bees, and in his beard the maggot sings. He comes again with litter of chips and empty cans, his shoes full of mud and dung. An army of shedding dogs attends him. The valley shudders where he stands, redolent of roses, exalted in the streaming rain. Yeah.
Did you write anything concerning the Friday earthquake?
The earthquake? Mm-hmm. I did write a poem about it, but I don't have it. I think it was published somewhere. But, I didn't think too much of it, but I don't have it.
What did you think too much of, the earthquake or your poem?
No, the poem. No, I thought enough of the earthquake. Yeah, we felt it even where we were, which is 300 or 400 miles north of where it happened. You think I'm... Read another poem? Anything? Well, I could read something I haven't read.
The Gardener?
The Gardener? Yeah. This is the second, one of two poems anyway, that I wrote partly out of something I read in Pasternak's Zhivago, where he talks about the possibility that some of the secrets men are looking for about life and death are contained in the flowers and the grass of the cemetery, but this, of course, comes back to my own experience simply as a gardener. His hoe makes a hush as of a stone rolled away. We who are standing here in rows, green men, small handfuls of death, we hardly know this one who tends us, dark, inscrutable angel whose step passes by.
You wrote me that Yevtushenko came to visit you in Alaska. Well, tell us something about it.
Well, we had no warning of it or advance notice. So it was the 28th of November. It was about 10 below zero, something like that, and nearly dark. It was a very beautiful evening. I'd actually had gone out and taken a photograph of the sunset, and we had gotten ready to settle down for evening and have something to drink, I think. And my wife looked out the window down toward the road, and she said, "Oh, there's somebody coming up the path." And so I went out at the front door, and suddenly this 3 or 4 or 5 people started coming around the side of the house, and I opened the door, and this big, tall fellow said, "My name is Todd. I'm from Queens University in New York, and I have a Russian poet come to see you." And I didn't believe him. I thought he was pulling my leg. But I said, "Come in." But as soon as I saw Yevtushenko, I recognized him. Well, everybody started talking at once. My wife and I were kind of numb, but he had this man, Todd, whom I understand later declared CIA by the Soviet government. But also a reporter and a photographer from Life and one from Holiday Magazine. So we had about 3 hours there. They brought a bottle of vodka, and we didn't have much of anything but a little blueberry wine. But we had a hell of a good visit. I read a poem or two of mine, and he recited something of his that he didn't ordinarily read on the platform. He's rather personal. And he told us one little joke. Maybe you probably have heard it, about the difference between communism and capitalism. You heard that? That under capitalism, man exploits man, and under communism, it's just the opposite. He, of course, you probably know, he reads and speaks English, understands it a lot better than he lets on to some people. It surprised me, anyway. As they were leaving, I said to somebody else, but he overheard me, I said, "Well, I hope you'll come back and see us, and maybe we'll have a bigger house. We have a very small house," and all these people filled it up, and Yevtushenko said, very clearly, he said, it's not the size of the house, it's the quality of the people that live in it. So I know he understands English pretty well. Well, am I about done?